Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 197, How to Make a Buddha.
Actually, see, that's the purpose of the creation stage. If you become adept in creating the Kalachakra universe and moving yourself into it meditatively. So meditation is like a dream, it's like a bardo of meditation. It's one of the six bardos, for example, betweens, you know, one of the six betweens. And because you can, in meditation, you can sort of do out-of-body stuff at the advanced levels when you get really concentrated. And a little bit meditation is kind of out-of-body. Of course, it's done in an escapist way in the sort of main level of people who just meditate without knowing anything ahead of time. They, of course, feel a little buzz from meditating because they're actually trying to escape from their anxiety-producing environment. And that, of course, won't work, really, long run, so that's not even the most important kind of meditation. And even you can become addictive and you can become stuck in it and dull your mind and like, oh, Kalachakra, oh, no, I don't know that, oh, no, I can't learn anything. You can't learn anything. So there's actually a negative effect of too much meditating. If you haven't learned something, what you're doing, you know, that's why the Zen people are so brilliant. The sixth patriarch and all the great Zen masters, you know that story where within the real top tradition of the Zen people in China, the guy was meditating. He tells a story. Baijiang was his name. And his great teacher was the great master Ma. And he was meditating in an old ruined temple. And he was like, you know, icicles in his beard in the winter and whatever. He didn't care. Just, you know. And then at a certain stage, Master Ma came out of the little huts that they had up in that center and would sit near him and would pick up a piece of tile from the broken temple and take another thing and rub on the tile. Scrape, scrape, scrape. And then he would meditate. Was extremely irritating and distracting, but he would like be using it as a thing. No, I'm not going to be distracted by that. You know, like. So then finally, it did get to him. He tells, as he tells the story, and he says, he distracts his meditation, and he asks his teacher. He says, "Why are you scraping on that tile?" And the master says, "I'm making a mirror." And then he says, "You can't make a tile into a mirror by rubbing it with a rock." And then the master says to him, "You can't make a Buddha by meditating." That's the Chan, which the name Chan comes from the Sanskrit word dhyana, which means meditate. Only wisdom creates liberation and enlightenment. Only wisdom. Meditation is just a tool in deepening that wisdom. But if it doesn't have the wisdom to deepen, it will deepen the ignorance. And this accounts for all these scandals and all these Dharma centers in Asia before even America. They meditated a lot. And then what do they discover after 20 years of really solid mind? "I'm the greatest!" Well, that's where they started, with naive egotism, selfishness. And then they become selfish, and then they're pain in the neck. But pain in other places too, very often. We see here when we hear about the scandal. Okay? So, why did I launch into that? What's the question? I'm sorry. What's the question? Oh, yeah, clear light. So, the point is, that's a great question because we're in, this is clear light. This is emptiness. Matter is emptiness. Emptiness is matter. Clear light is only the event horizontal way of expressing emptiness as not nothingness. It's pure light. And light has, even materialist science has the same paradox. They just sort of don't think about it because they have nothing that's waiting. But the speed of light in the standard model based on general relativity, et cetera, is 186,000 miles per second, although you know something has never been measured as that, or something nearby it. And Rupert Sheldrake has a great thing in his book where he goes in England to the Bureau of Standards, and he says, how come it's 186,000 miles? Because nobody's ever measured it that. It's 185, 990, something like that. It's never measured 186,000. And then the guy there, the officer in charge, says, well, they're all wrong. Well, how do you know they're wrong? Well, because we say it's 186,000. That's how we know it's they're wrong. That's an evidence-based science, right? That's a dogma. But the point is, why is that an absolute? Because mass becomes infinite at that speed. And by the way, that speed is measured in relation to what? There's no ultimate frame of reference in the universe. So mass becomes infinite simply means that it becomes too subtle to find. So there would be no light because every light would be infinite and we would never, we would be blinded, all of us. We'd all disappear. And, you know, we see things. So light, we are light. We're interacting with light. We're interacting with a bunch of infinite mass. But we think we have a finite mass and it's measured against what? And the speed of light is measured against what? It's apart from you going 55 miles an hour or 75 miles an hour down the thruway. 186,000, wow. But that's just the boundary. That's what they're describing is the boundary between the form realm, the Brahma heaven, and the realm of infinite space, the medium of infinite space where there's no more sense of volume. But mind is there. And there's very subtle energy, too subtle for them to find. Disappears when they look for it. Now they're calling it dark energy and dark matter. Now they say 97%. They don't know what they're talking about, actually. In fact, they just assert it, and you have to believe it, like any high priest. Like, you know the joke. I've told you the joke, the theologian's joke that I learned from Langdon Gilkey at the University of Chicago, a great theologian. The preacher who is asking the congregation, now, y'all, I want to know if y'all can tell me what faith is. You know, you all pious, believing in Christ, Jesus Christ. Like, what is faith? Tell us what is faith. No silence. Nobody says anything. Come on now, y'all. Tell me faith. Nobody says anything. Then little Johnny in the front row is dislocating his shoulder. He's doing the Richard. He's stretching the muscle, the whatever it is. Psoas muscle. And so he keeps ignoring him. Then finally he says, okay, little Johnny, you know what faith is? Why don't you tell all these good folks what faith? Ain't you all ashamed of yourself? Only little Johnny thinks he knows. Johnny, okay, little Johnny, what's faith? You know what it is, Johnny? I know what it is, preacher. Okay, will you tell the good folks? He says, yes, I will, preacher. Faith is believing what you know ain't true. That's what, and their scientism, actually, Houston Smith made a great expression for it. He calls it scientism. And it's the religion of dogmatic materialism. And it's holding back science because the method of science is awesome. It's great. It's the Buddhist method. You trust your experience. And to them, that's only measuring something. And they don't want to have to measure something with their mind. You know, their intuition, they're not going to trust it. And in a way, that's good because there can be kind of defiled intuition by the ignorant person who hasn't separated their ignorant attitude from their actual experience there. And they think it's experience when actually they're dominating it by a false concept. We pretend to ourselves that we're afraid of nothing. They convince themselves. And they think people who are aware of their future existence and that in a way that they are these infinite beings because they're clear light and they want to be enjoying the clear light in a good form. And they think they are just chicken. They're chicken to be the good French existentialist with the Gauloises over here and a bon vin, some Calvados over there and whatever, you know. Filet de sole and then the l'épingle de Margot, you know. And I'm ready to be nothing. And that's really brave. That's not brave. You have a toothache, you want to be nothing. You want to be anesthetized. And that's relief. Being nothing is relief when you have pain. And it's relief mentally for fear of pain. So it's a total blind, and that's the worst blind faith. The one thing that nobody will ever have evidence for the existence of is nothingness. Nobody will ever find it. And they can, common sense tells anybody that. And yet those guys go around, even these guys who are writing books now, who've been talking with the Tibetans, they write these books like The Enlightened Gene, they say. And then another one wrote a book like Buddhism is True, one scientist, biologist. And then right in the preface, he says, well, I don't mean reincarnation. No, they don't need all that old religious fanatic stuff. They pretend that's blind faith because they act like people who remember previous lives are just crazy. And they're not crazy believing they're going to be nothing at death where there's no evidence, and yet they're supposed to be scientists. And no one's ever discovered nothing. They never will. And they can know that right off the top. But do they? No. They go around believing in nothing. That's crazy. That's psychotic. And such people are reckless and irresponsible, furthermore. That's why the planet is a mess. Because their culture has, their thing has become popular culture of the elites who have all the buttons, own everything. Right? It isn't just because of some greedy oil guy. They're just secondary to the basic idea that we don't care because it doesn't matter. Go for it. Ultimately, it doesn't matter. Recklessness. You're not reckless if you're there forever. You're going to take care of every little bit of it. You're going to make it the best mandala for everybody. And you don't want anybody else freaking out because you're stuck with them. There's a enlightened self-interest in that.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. Part podcast was originally recorded during the annual Kali Chakra Study and Practice Intensives held at Menla Retreat and Dewa Spa in the heart of the Catskills, just 2 hours north of New York City. To learn more about these annual programs open to all Vajrayana practitioners or those who have received the Kali Chakra initiation, please visit menla.us. In addition to these study and practice intensives, Professor Thurman will be joined at Menla Retreat in Dewa Spa in 2019 for programs with Dr. Nita, Dr. Isa, Dr. Mark Epstein, Sharon Salzberg, Krishna Das, and other teachers. Two of my favorite programs include Buddha and the Yogis with Richard Freeman and Mary Taylor, and any programs Professor Thurman does with Dr. Isa G from the Foundation for the Sacred Stream. To learn more about these programs, please visit menla.us or tibethouse.us. If traveling to the Catskills isn't an option, stay tuned for upcoming announcements about Professor Thurman's West Coast visit, including teachings at BuddhaFest LA with Sharon Salzberg and Dr. Nita. To learn more about BuddhaFest LA, please visit buddhafest.org. This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including access to the Tibet House member archives at tibethouse.us, please visit tibethouse.us. For free weekly previews from member archive videos, please subscribe to the Tibet House US Menla Retreat YouTube channel. You can find them on YouTube by just typing in tibethouse.us. Every like, subscription, comment, and share helps support Tibet House's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture, both online and in person at Tibet House US in New York City and at Menla in Phoenicia, New York. Links to these videos are provided each week on the Bob Thurman podcast page at bobthurman.com. Weekly interstitial music for the Bob Thurman podcast is generously provided by Tenzing Chogyal. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, please visit tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode, which includes a reading of the poetry of Mary Oliver by Gary Gock.
We're going back to the foundation. So please go into meditative mode. What we're going to do this morning. Please go into meditative mode. And I will include in what I send the three principal paths. And because that's what I want you to meditate right now. Okay, so first starting, you think about your guru, which is the Dalai Lama. And His Holiness Dalai Lama, and you think about whatever your vision of him is, and setting in your mind that he, in this context, is indivisible from Kalachakra, father, mother, whatever you're seeing in your mind's eye, in the space above, and in the mandala, and whatever your sort of sense of the mandala universe sitting there in front of you or something like that. And that's the guru. And then, but he's aware of you. And you feel grateful, and you feel the graciousness, you feel the field, you remember imagining whenever you were close to him how it felt. That's where you start. And behind him, stretching up toward infinity, the lineage of all the Buddhas, etc., Shambhala, the kings of Shambhala, Kalachakra, whatever it is, all the great Indian pundits, the great Tibetan masters, and so on. Then you reflect on how precious you are, how precious your moments of time are. What a huge success you are of having become a human being, and what is your evolutionary nature as a human being, and how lucky it is you're not any kind of other animal or deity or titan or preta or hell being, and you're this amazing human. And whatever your gender, how lucky that you're beyond that and could be either, but whatever you are, that's great also. And if you're lucky enough to be female, how superior that is, and how you should feel no compunction about correcting anything that seems to be male chauvinist, like your chakras and whatever. And remember, there's always red bodhicitta as well as white bodhicitta, and the subtle body of the yogin, perfection stage yogin. Female element as well as male in every body. Okay? And really feel good about yourself for that reason, not because of your looks, not because of your possessions, not because of your relationships, not because of this or that, but because you are this amazing human with this amazing sensitivity, self-critical awareness, analytic insight. You're just amazing. And you're also lucky to be in a world where there are Buddha, there has been Buddha. There have been many who have realized Buddhahood. There may be some now present who are Buddhahood. And all of those who are like that from an infinite past, which doesn't therefore limit the number of such beings, they all feel they are you now. And somehow what your Buddha nature is your sense of connection to them. Feel that. And overcome this notion, which is the underlying structure, the Abrahamic structure of our culture, that somehow you're this lowly worm and then there's this great being somewhere else that somehow made you and put you through these hoops, and you should, anything you feel about yourself as you are great is a sin, you know, Satan is some kind of pride against the great deity who is out there. You know, that's the dualistic idea of the Abrahamic traditions, except for their mystical parts. And it's therefore underlying our culture, and even in the materialist culture, underlying is that the absolute is nothing, and it's the great final peace, and we are naturally crawling around trying to like avoid pain as best we can and failing ultimately until we become nothing. So there's also a dualism of a great absolute of nothing outside there, elsewhere. I was just thinking when we read that, it says matter is voidness, voidness is matter, matter is not other than voidness. I think that I can translate the other almost better, more graphically, by saying matter is not elsewhere than voidness. Voidness is not elsewhere than matter. I think making it a locational term might be good. Instead of other, you know, then the alternative Kalachakra, the word is just other, but, you know, it's, we call it alternative in that case, to emphasize that. So enjoy your marvelousness, then think about your death, face it, bring death on board as an advisor, as Don Juan used to say to Carlos Castaneda, advising you about what is important about life, in other words, the immediacy of death, that it could be any time, and that when it comes, it is your soul that goes on, which is the genetic code of your spiritual openness versus closedness, basically. It's whether the code is open, relating to open-heartedness, and you therefore will seek a more open-hearted form of embodiment, or it's closed, and you will be paranoidly seeking a more closed form of embodiment. That's the key. So everything about your practice, your top priority in life, is always keeping your mind and heart and hands open, keeping and nervous system. And as a yogi, it's opening your channels and nervous system. And that gets encoded, whatever degree of that you live in. You know, you are yourself and yourself is open. And whatever degree you live in that, by being altruistic, by having bodhicitta, then to that degree, you're safe, actually, at the deepest inner level. You're close to the clear light of the void. You're living the relativity as an absolute, in other words, as it's the whole as an absolute, not any one piece, true relativity. Then you think about, therefore, any other future existence you might aim at will also be imperfect, any future relative existence, and how difficult it is to open yourself and to save lives and not take lives as opposed to taking lives, to give gifts as opposed to taking away others' properties, to be completely open in sensuality as opposed to grabbing pleasure for yourself, to be completely truthful as opposed to creating false worlds through lies, to being completely peacemaking between others as opposed to, like causing dissension among others to try to get more attention to yourself, to truly speak meaningfully as opposed to babble meaninglessly, and to truly speak sweetly as opposed to speaking harshly, and to be truly generous in mind and detached and renunciate as opposed to being greedy and covetous, to being truly loving and tolerant as opposed to being malicious and angrisome and irritable, and being truly realistic and connected to relativity as opposed to being enclosing yourself in some rigid worldview. Those are the tenfold path of openness and closedness, which we would think of as ethics, and how difficult it is to stay on the open end of that kind of spectrum. So thinking those two things, then decide that the best way of opening is to think of liberation and nirvana all the time and make that your priority and not just a better worldly situation. Although it doesn't mean those are not priority, a better worldly situation, but they are priorities and there's a hierarchy of priorities among them, but they are not the highest priority. Highest priority is liberation, nirvana, freedom. Total openness, in other words, that's the highest priority because that's where the true, that's following your bliss, the true bliss, not the temporary one, the real one, the one that comes out of reality, realistic bliss. And then you are renunciant. You are transcendently renunciant. And then you feel better. And you don't worry that, well, I'm not getting to here on time, or I'm not getting that done, or I got to go here and do the other, and I got to go see that one, and I have this duty, the other one. And those things you're all going to still do, but you'll be more relaxed about them because they are not your top priority. Your top priority is to remember nirvana at all times. Remember that it's accessibility. Remember its closeness. Remember it's closer to you than, as they say in Islam, closer to you than your own jugular vein. Great thing the Sufis say. I think they even say it in the Quran, actually. Allah is closer to you than your own jugular. That's the openness side in the Abrahamics. And that's the mystic side. Okay, so then you transcend. Then you're feeling better. Then the little thing trickles up from your navel chakra. And you're into your heart chakra and trickles down from your brain into your heart chakra. And you feel kind of as if the clamp around your heart that they left in at birth. The forceps that have been like dangling around your heart, constricting its beating, squeezing your lungs and making you feel uptight in life and anxious. You feel like a little bit release of that. Like somebody took an x-ray and they saw there was a clamp around your heart and your lungs and you were feeling squished in life and therefore anxious and you feel a little ease in the heart center. And then the minute you do, you completely become sensitive to the dis-ease, the uneasiness in the hearts of those around you mostly, except for your Vajra brothers and sisters, true Vajra brothers and sisters who have the same openness orientation that you are cultivating. And you therefore realize how much they are suffering and you see them rushing off, putting the wrong thing in top priority, thinking that's going to make them happy, rushing after things that are addictive and will make them unhappy and wreck their evolutionary trajectory, and you generate true compassion. And then you realize that only if you become fully enlightened are you going to be able to help them. So you want to become fully enlightened. Yes, you know, you have a sense of there are all these Buddhas who are helping them already, but they don't. It seems to you like the ones you know about are not being helped enough. There's too much suffering still. So you're going to take responsibility for them yourself, and you're going to become a Buddha for their sake. And then that you create the bodhicitta, the mental level of bodhicitta, conceptual level of bodhicitta. And then when you make a vow, it becomes the deep inner motivation level when you took your bodhisattva vow. And then you realize in order to realize that transcendence that you renounced about, that you put as your high priority, to realize this ability to help others in a truly effective and sure fire way, you need wisdom. You acknowledge to yourself that deep in your gut there's some sense inside yourself of a real intrinsically identifiable intrinsic identity bearing you, an identity habit mongering you, and you do feel that. Even they can say selflessness or supreme self, the great self, not the little self. They can say all these kind of things. and you agree with them mentally, but viscerally, no. Someone comes up and steps on your toe, and you react from this visceral, like, I'm really here, and don't step on my toe. So acknowledging that to yourself, look for it, verify it, do the four keys. First, acknowledge it. Second, either I'll find it or I won't find it. No third option. Third, I find it as part of what I can be aware of in my five aggregates of body, sensation, conception, emotion, and consciousness. I can't find it as the same thing. And then I can't find it as a separate thing that is sort of unchanging, absolute me that somehow has strings attached to my changing processes and aggregates. And when I really look consciously and critically and analytically, but paired with one-pointed penetrating concentration, I enter into space like equipoise samadhi, where I let go. I even confront a fear of nothingness, a visceral fear of it. I know nothing is nothing intellectually, but a visceral fear I still have that everything might be nothing. I don't want to be nothing. It's not that bad. And yet let go anyway. And then finding the emptiness, which is actually the relativity, cancels the nothing. Sees that nothing is empty of being nothing. And we're back in all the illusory relative things. So there's no fear of nothing. Therefore, no fear of death. And back in the illusory dreamlike world, able to access a kind of space world, but not get attached to a space world as that elsewhere emptiness from matter, which it isn't. It's just itself a very important relative experience, overcoming fear of nothing, overcoming fear of death, and realizing relativity. And once fully realizing relativity, realizing that there can be the most exquisite relativity, which is the love relativity, which is where you just overflow with love, immeasurable love. And then beings resonate with that, and the potential, the human potential for immeasurable love is activated in all the beings. You see them as all beautiful. Love is in the eye of the beholder. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. When you love a being, they are beautiful. And you love all beings, and they're all beautiful. And that's possible. As still a relativity. A form we can conceive of conceptually called a Buddha is also a relativity, but it's the best relativity. And once relativity is infinite and endless, not eternal in a fixed, unchanging way, but eternal in a continuum way, which is the word meaning of Tantra, then you want to make things optimal, the relativity as optimal as possible, bringing all your loved beings into it, expanding the number of your loved beings as a bodhisattva, loving all of the beings, even your enemies. And this makes you want to practice Kala Chakra. Okay? So this is the foundation of it. This makes it logical to practice Kala Chakra. This makes it logical to again and again rehearse the death process, the bardo process, and the rebirth process. In that every night you fall deep asleep and you associate that with entering the clear light of sleep, merging the clear light of sleep with the clear light of death, merging the clear light of sleep and death with the clear light of Buddhahood, becoming a Vajra being every single night. Then the dream, you merge the clear light of the dream with the clear light of the bardo, of the, you know, driven around like unconsciously, even like the shrinks kind of will tell you that you don't want to lucidly dream because you want your unconscious to pop up to you in the dream. There's some psychiatry type people who have that attitude, that it would be bad to be lucidly dreaming all the time because then you couldn't get informed about the state of your unconscious by things popping up that you don't expect, which is valid actually on the level that they're working. But you want to be lucid completely and you want to deal with, but you have to deal with all those surprises in meditation. You have to find your dark side. You have to find your traumas and your fears and your things. And you do that as a Kala Chakra. You confront them as a Vajravega in meditative. And you mingle the bardo of meditation with the bardo of actually death and rebirth and with the Sambhogakaya of the Buddha. And it's all the being in the illusion-like, dream-like, aftermath samadhi-like sense of being the continuum of the previous, you know, identity habit holding indivisible self, and feeling melting into infinite oneness with all Buddha selves, all completely wide open selves, which only is achieved through the great bliss, through the total orgasmic bliss of the whole universe is orgasm, meaning open to each other, to every atom open to the next one, every cell, every molecule, every being. That's the Sambhogakaya. It's that event horizon, that non-duality of emptiness and matter, and the ultimate matter that is completely open to its own emptiness and therefore able to relate to other matter, which is actually the reality of it. That's why things do. The strong force of the universe is the clear light. That's truly what the strong force is. And it's actually the virtual equivalent of love, in the sense that it is a level or a fabric or a field of infinite energy, inexhaustible energy, that is abundantly available to anything that needs energy. And of course, all sensitive beings that need energy, they need it for happiness. They need it for avoiding of pain. And so therefore, the foundation of reality is love. Meaning, giving of whatever every being needs, every sensitive being needs. So that's the Sambhogakaya practice. And then anything that seems to be back into more solid, individual, differentiated, different things, which are even seen habitually where my perspective on them seems to be the real one. Like when I see something from one angle, it seems like that's what the thing is, and not seeing it from all angles. One comes back in that, in interacting with the beings there, and then, therefore, the waking state and the rebirth life state and the Nirmanakaya, emanation body of the Buddha, altruistically interrelating with other beings in whatever way serves them optimally, at least as the ideal. As the way that, as the measure, as the standard that one sets. That's then the Nirmanakaya. So death between and birth are connected with Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya, reality body or truth body, bliss body or beatific body, and emanation body, magical emanation body. Okay? So, now we could turn to our sadhana, but not looking at a piece of paper in your mind. I think to yourself, I will give some credibility, at least consciously, but maybe not pretending I wholly do so in my unconscious, but consciously, I will take refuge that there has been somebody in history, in an infinite past history, in some world or another, who has completely achieved the Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya, at least somebody, actually infinite numbers of somebodies, given infinity and a continuum being beginningless. So I will take refuge in the awareness of those and the teachings and the helpful activities and the miracles of that somebody. I will take refuge in the reality that somebody fused with experientially and therefore has the abilities that are a tribute to that somebody of helping others and therefore being helpful to me. I will take refuge in the community of those who are oriented toward that reality and toward that one who was aware of that reality, who understood that reality and was able to provide methods for us to understand it. All the while admitting no one can fully explain it. no one can express it. It's inconceivable, actually. Not pretending to be somehow omnipotent about it. That was a relief. So that's a refuge. Then I meditate, I realize that I am interconnected with everybody else. I am subjected to their vibes. I am interwoven with them. In previous lives, I've been one body with them. I've been in their wombs when they were mothers, mammal mothers, human, and especially human mothers also. So I'm completely flesh and blood and spirit and mind and energy totally interwoven with other beings. And therefore, in order to find the bliss of nirvana and experience it and feel it, all of them have to do so. I have to bring them all with me. I have to help them find it. Even if there's no omnipotent way of doing so, I have to get as close to that as I can. What a Buddha is, what I call omnicompetent. Not omnipotent, but omnicompetent. That's the Bodhisattva vow. And I'm going to do that all my life. No separation. Absolutely do that. Then, next, I imagine. I join in millions of people, actually, having imagined this omnicompetent being as the best possible mother, father, helper, protector, teacher, exemplar, model, for me to model myself toward. And I realize the Buddhist cure for idolatry is realizing that any image of this Buddha being is of a being who's completely shared itself with me, with everyone. So this omnicompetent being becomes omnicompetent by the body of reality, including everybody. So whatever I imagine the Buddha as, in a way, is instantaneously shared with me. Because that's the awareness of such a being. And so, seeing again my guru, indivisible from Kala Chakra, father, mother, which is what I'm visualizing, this omnicompetent, omnicompassionate, omniscient being, omniscient by being everything, not by being able to express it or describe it, but by being it. So that is me. That's actually the initiation. Is that sort of ritual or ceremonial, contemplative enacting of the ultimate being imaginable, expressing that it feels one with me. So that is the instantaneous self-creation or self-generation as the one-faced, two-arm Kala Chakra, the blue Kala Chakra at the beginning of the sadhana. Right? You recognize that in the shortest sadhana. There you are. And then, while being able to hold the paradoxical cognitive dissonance of affirming that at least one of the partners, me and the Kala Chakra father, mother, guru, indivisible in front of me, one of us as partners feels one. That I and it are the same, but acknowledging that I don't feel one, but I want to feel one, but I don't, then I feel the blessing come to me. But, oh yeah, no, I want to reach out to that though, and the way of opening myself is by giving everything. So I imagine these deities that are there somewhere in my unconscious, these exquisite goddesses. You could throw in some male gods, few trans people, a few androgynes, whatever you like. You know, the chauvinist cultures, they practice having goddesses come out because they have to be the waitresses. We're going to have some waiters. We have some, like, Baryshnikov-level dancing waiters coming out holding bowls of mango nectar, holding elixirs, holding for the food, you know, playing violin, Bach, you know, solos, you know, concertos, you know, playing, doing rock and roll, whatever, you know, all of the music and scents, the most magnificent perfumes and ointments and unguents and flowers, beautiful flowers, you know, orchids and whatever you can think of, and magnificent robes and textures, you know, silken brocades and whatever it is. And imagine just floods of these going toward this Kalachakra father, mother. Sort of everything I can possibly think of as something beautiful and exquisite and desirable, offering it. And so you end up that kind of offering sequence. As elaborate as you want to make it, you can read Shantideva's chapter there where he imagines even taking those Kalachakra father, mother, and the guru to a spa and putting them in a beautiful far infrared sauna and like having the best masseurs and masseuses, you know, pulling out all the pains and things from any kind of, or imagine even, or just adding to their bliss, whatever way. A Deva spa, a Deva Chembo spa, a Mahasukha spa. Imagine that. Offering medicines, offering buildings, offering beautiful architecture, offer whatever it is. You know. Countries, planets, giving them. So you go through a meditation like that. And this makes you feel connected to the object of your generosity. And then you reflect about any negativities that you have in your past karmas. And in a way, if it's given the past is infinite, we have all of them, all of us. We have that dark side that's as dark as anybody's dark side. And we have it sort of all in an infinite past, and therefore its potential in our own unconsciousness. And we decide we don't want it, and we want to. That's how we will improve. That's how we will become like the Kalachakra father, mother, by getting rid of all negativity in ourselves. So we repent it and we confess it to the Kalachakra assembly of all the deities around the Father, Mother, Central One. And that's one verse that we recite like that. Everything negative that I did, I caused others to do, or I admired others as doing. I set it aside. I drop it into emptiness. I see it through it. I see its transparency. Actually, I see it was just clear light anyway. It's actually the only quote-unquote kind of absolution. But anyway, I get rid of it. I resolve to get rid of it. Then I think, oh, but somebody, this my guru became a Buddha. You know, Kalachakra, Shakyamuni became a Kalachakra, created such a magnificent art form of total competence. Mastering time and space, turning it into a mandala of evolutionary, optimal evolutionary positivity for beings. And I rejoice in their achievement. I have no jealousy. I restrict myself. And any achievement of anybody, any good thing that everybody did, I rejoice in it. And then I share in the joy that they have of doing it and the merit that they achieve of doing it. That is that verse. And then I request, of course, this omnicompetent being, don't just lounge around in the clear light, please manifest forms that I need to see. Show me a mirror reflection of my own potential and possibility. Give me the methods. Teach me the yogas. Teach me the meditations, please. And don't one-sidedly lay down and just be nirvana as if it were apart from this world that I'm in. So one does that, ask them, turn the wheel of Dharma for me and stay with us forever. Don't leave. We know you're free. You could stay at the event horizon of the of the clear light as long as you want it, but don't. Please, be compassionate. And finally, whatever merit I do, I dedicate it to becoming Buddha as fast as possible for all sake of all living beings through the path and the yoga and the mandala of the time machine Buddha. We recognize all this in your sadhana, in the little verses that you recite. But these are the meanings that you want to put your mind through. And we finish that round. That's the key round. And then we finish that round. And then we dissolve that mandala. And then we then give Agni a thank you round of the 12 things. And then the dedication, et cetera, and we enjoy. And the way we do it in the Menla habit, when we've done a retreat with people who are even, you know, whatever kind, even if it isn't a formal Kala Chakra retreat, and they, and each set of offerings, we sort of pass around the little dish, and each person does a little bit of the offering. Whenever you do a full-scale retreat, you then make the offering as you're the one who actually is the main. You have the vajras and the bell, and you do the main thing. But since it's too awkward to try to do that, everyone participates in the way that we're doing it. Okay? So that's what we're going to do then.
You might hear in the background contractors doing earthquake retrofitting in my building. It's the second day of hard rains here in San Francisco, where this morning everyone felt a tremor. And then a few hours later, I heard word that Mary Oliver had gone into the bardo. So as she makes her final transition into the light, I'd like to read a poem, Mindful, by Mary Oliver. She was, if you haven't heard, a Pulitzer laureate whose work is grounded in and grows out of a relationship between self and the world of owls, hummingbirds, egrets, ponds, the sun, and Walt Whitman, Thoreau, the Buddha, Mozart. Every day I see or hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It was what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extravagant, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teachings as these? The untrimmable light of the world, the ocean's shine, the prayers that are made out of grass. I'm Gary Gough, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.